What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Before actually we even get into today, I'm going to take a moment of silence for Asada Shakur, who transitioned last week, many of us for whom, many of us for whom she was a hero, on whom we built our political stance and principles on. I can say that for me, reading the book Asada changed my life forever. I can't think of how many times I've been at protests, and we've closed with it's our duty to fight for our freedom. It's our duty to win. We must love and protect one another. We have nothing to lose but our chains. My brother in struggle and the co-founder of the anti-police terror project, Terha Ox, says often he teaches us that when our loved ones transition to the other side, it is from the other side of the veil that they can do more for us, for the struggle, for their life's purpose than they could do here. And I've really been sitting with that since her transition. And I mean, when you think about what she accomplished, when you think about the movements that she not only led but inspired, when you think about that she died free despite this country trying to hunt her down like a dog, and y'all's favorite president, Obama, upping the bounty on her head. Oh, by the way, you cannot love and you cannot uplift Obama and Kamala and Asada. You have to pick. You have to choose. You have to choose a side because they're not the same. That's a tangent I don't have time for this morning. But she died free. She stood up for Black breathing, Black liberation, Black freedom, and she died free and of natural causes. I can't think of a time, another political time, where we need an ancestor like Asada who can be moving stuff on the other side for us. So presente Asada Shakur, rise in power. Thank you for a life well-lived and so many more lives inspired to do our best, our meager best, to follow in your footsteps. Curry, I want to just give you a second if you want to say anything before we move on to what we're supposed to be talking about today.
I really appreciate that, Kat, and of course appreciate your tribute. And I will say, yeah, reading Asada's autobiography, which honestly, I find myself reread. It's the book that I reread the most, and every time I reread it, I find something speaks to me in a new way. But there's one passage that I always go back to, which is a chapter in which she's basically talking about how she came to be in solidarity with people in communities other than hers. She talks about meeting Puerto Rican revolutionaries, you know, in New York, and realizing upon meeting them that she didn't know much about Puerto Rico and about the Puerto Rican struggle that she needed to learn. And she talks about going to the Bay Area and how formative an experience that was for her, and in particular meeting the indigenous folks who at that point were occupying, in a good way, Alcatraz Island, and made it a center, a site of indigenous resistance and rebellion. And she talked about how she realized upon talking to these folks that her quote unquote knowledge, you know, of indigenous peoples was informed by visits to the Museum of Natural History, you know, that put them on, that were not crafted by indigenous peoples, you know, in the 1960s, that told a very different story. And what she said was, I realized that to be in solidarity with other people, I had to learn their stories, I had to learn their heroes, and that is at the heart of what guides my approach to solidarity and internationalism. And I think about it every time I think about learning about the Palestinian struggle, which I know we're going to talk about today. So, endless gratitude for Asada and all that she has done and will do, frankly, for generations to come, and for me and for you.
Yes, yes, yes. For folks here in the Bay Area, APTP will be holding I don't know. We're going to call it Celebration of Life, Celebration of Legacy. Stay tuned for that. And for the cities that you're in, for those of you that are connected to Black Liberatory Groups, there will be commemorations, teach-ins, poetry readings, right, all over, all of the time. I sat yesterday on a Black August Organizing Committee, which was my first political formation here in the Bay, and they did a teach-in about her life. And so this is, if you don't know who Asada is, this is a really good time to get to know who she is. All right. It is not only not what I'm supposed to be talking about today. Oh, we will be doing a special current. I'm going to have you back. We're going to do a little Black Power panel this week. But it's fun driving. We got to talk about Palestine, and I don't have as much time to talk about Palestine because I got to raise money. So, y'all, it's been 724 days. Excuse me. It's been 724 days since October 7th, 2023. And today's casualties update, there have been 67,000 Palestinians murdered by Israel since October 7th, 2023. And upwards of 168,346 people have been wounded. This includes hundreds of journalists and over 500 people murdered by starvation. A statement from the ministry said 33 people were killed in the past 24 hours. That number's always higher. By the time I get to you all, just so you know, that number's always higher. That's just the last I'm getting off of Al Jazeera. And then we know from researchers outside of the PHM that the death toll is closer to 80,000. And even that is likely an undercount. We've spent the last majority of our Mondays for almost 2 years, could to be 2 years in like 2 weeks. Bringing Palestine Post, where we push back on the Israeli and U.S. mainstream media campaign of disinformation. And for almost 2 years, a lot of Mondays, Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration, has joined us. All right, I think you probably know where we're going today and where we're going to start anyway. Trump's 21-point peace plan. That's what it's called, y'all. It's called a peace plan. It's a I mean, you know, and the one you got to give, they're consistent, right? They're consistent in the jackassery. 21-point peace plan. It is out in the world. It's not actually in the hands of Hamas, though somebody's told them what's in it. And Trump has promised something very special for Gaza this week. Curry, do you know what's in the 21-point peace plan? You want to walk us through some of those points?
Sure. yeah, this plan was revealed by the content of this plan was revealed by the Times of Israel. And so they published more or less what's in the plan. One thing that's kind of interesting is that there is another, there's a few plans in quotes floating around, one of which was supposedly devised by Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of the UK, who listeners may remember was, he led the UK's central role in the illegal, catastrophic, and I will say genocidal invasion of Iraq in 2003, you know, and he lied about, along with the Bush administration, lied about the pretext to do that invasion. So that's Tony Blair. that's where he's coming from. He has also been working on quote-unquote peace for Gaza. And then the French and Saudi governments have also been working on a plan. And all these plans are very similar. They call for a, you know, their words, demilitarized and de-radicalized Gaza that will not pose a threat to anybody. These are their words. But the idea being to neutralize, you know, Hamas and any political organization that that vows to oppose, you know, what Israel was doing in Palestinian land is not allowed. Some of these plans have some role for the Palestinian Authority, others don't. Trump has said that, if both parties agree to this plan, then Israeli hostages will need to be released within 48 hours. The so-called war, really the genocide, will have to end more or less immediately. and that hundreds of Palestinian captives will also be freed. So those are the kind of rough outlines of the plan. We can get into the pretty straightforward problems with it, but that's kind of what it is.
But you know, is exactly where I want to go. There is, I was going to end with this, but I actually think I want to start with this because there is actually something different about this U.S. plan, something notably different. I mean, it's something that both you and I, you know, think is useless at this point in time. But still, after forever and always saying never would the United States support a two-state solution or Palestine being its own state, this plan, I mean, after all of these other conditions are met, of course, and the brown people do as they're told, and they do it on the timeline that the white people say that they're supposed to do it on. I'm in a mood this morning. Can you tell? Then perhaps there's this conversation about a two-state solution of Palestine being able to tell its own self what to do. Where did that come from? This is the Trump administration. I was actually just watching. Have you seen this? I know you have. The Gaza Trump, the video that they put out with the AI of Elon Musk. And anyway, that's for later. But like, that's, I mean, that's, this is a pivot. This is something. Question for you. A, what do you think it's for? And then B, like, is it possible? Because is it possible that Trump's ramped up agitation has anything to do with the bombing of Qatar?
His agitation?
Yeah, that now he's saying, because he also, we'll get into the West Bank later, but like his flip in position. I mean, this is a flip. I'm not saying it makes the administration any better than the vile thing it is.
Of course.
But it's notable.
Yeah, it's worth noting for sure. I mean, it has to be said, you know, the so-called two-state solution has been stated U.S. policy for a long time, you know, and the U.S.'s actions and certainly Israel's actions, of course, contradict it. So the idea that you can kind of on paper or in words say that we're for, you know, at some point a Palestinian state, but in practice, you know, arm and defend the entity that is committing genocide and settling, you know, the land to prevent that kind of state from happening. That is something that is, you know, I think that Trump can kind of have his cake and eat it too. But I think you're right to know there's something there. You know, one thing is that there has been this kind of complicated momentum around the world in support, at least in word, of a Palestinian state, right? There's all these for a long time, actually, like well over 100 states have said they support a Palestinian state. But more recently, U.S. and Israeli allies, you know, like the U.K. And, you know, various other Western European countries and Australia, you know, they're saying that they support a Palestinian state. And that's new, and that is complicated because it is responding to pressure from their populations and indeed the world's population to do something, anything to stop this genocide. And yet, you know, it is, as many Palestinian scholars have pointed out, you know, it's not substantially doing what the call is for, which is actually stopping the genocide. And yet there is this momentum for it. I mean, it seems to be the kind of option of choice, you know, for various governments, Western governments that are compelled to do something. And so, you know, is Trump also responding to those same pressures? I mean, certainly, you know, in the kind of bizarre, like, funhouse mirror, like Trump doesn't want, Trump has made it very clear from the start of this, you know, he has said, in his words, wrap this up, finish the job. He doesn't care how it's done, but he does not like the genocide in Gaza to be in the headlines. He doesn't like it because he wants to be in the headlines and it keeps him in the spotlight. You know what I mean? Like it is increasingly becoming a problem in U.S. politics. It complicates his relationship with Netanyahu and with Israel. And so he has said, wrap this up. And, you know, this is the kind of latest iteration of him throwing things out there. So I think it's worth noting that he's kind of voicing an openness or whatever to the two-state solution on paper. And yet, I think that part of that is because he's mad that this is still in the news and he wants it to end.
So he can say he did it. Look what he did for all them brown people. He also, House member, said a few days ago that he was not, I mean, again, this is like, what are you saying? Because it's happening already. He said out loud, he was like, I will not allow Israel to annex the West Bank. Where did that come from and what does that gibberish mean?
I mean, again, in practice, he is very much allowing Israel. I mean, Israel is annexing the West Bank.
Here's a bomb. Like, you play nice with it.
Yeah, I mean, right. You know, but I mean, you know, I had a conversation with the Palestinian journalist Mariam Barghouti, you know, recently. You know, she lives in the West Bank, and she said that she feels like she's living in an Israeli settlement. You know, I mean, she lives in a Palestinian village. She said she feels like she's living in an Israeli settlement. And I said, well, that's really interesting, because when you look at a map of the West Bank and the way that we here have thought about it and talked about it for a long time, is that the West Bank is occupied Palestinian territory. It is Palestinian land that is dotted with Israeli settlements. And I said, it sounds like what you are saying is the opposite, that this has become land controlled by Israel that is dotted with Palestinian enclaves. And she said, that is right. That is what it's like here. We are surrounded by the Israelis. And so Israel is annexing the West Bank in practice. They're doing it with U.S. weapons. You know, there are various states that have tried to put sanctions on the settlers who are leading this, including the settlers who are in the government right now, Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, who are themselves settlers and leaders in the settler movement. The U.S. has opposed sanctions on them. So Trump is very much allowing the annexation of the West Bank. You know, I mean, again, it is interesting that he rhetorically has to say something about it, but in practice, he's allowing it.
Netanyahu is here. He's here today. Again, there's an international warrant out for his arrest. We're arresting people left, right, and center in this country. They're going to arrest Netanyahu.
Well,
it's an international warrant.
Yeah, I mean, the president has been convicted. we're talking about criminality. The White House itself, we could start there. So, but yeah, I mean, it says a lot that, I mean, you know, folks probably know, maybe don't know that to get here now, to get to the United States, Netanyahu's airplane has to take this complicated route because he is afraid to fly over the airspace of certain countries that will enforce international law. And if he lands, you know, planes have to land all the time for whatever reason. You know, they are concerned that if they land in one of these countries that he will be arrested. So he has to take this flight path that zigzags, you know, across the Atlantic, and adds, you know, a few hundred miles to the trip. To avoid arrest. So it says a lot that the White House welcomes him with open arms after he evades arrest elsewhere.
No, because I'm hashtag petty, that couple extra 100 miles makes me happy. a large chunk of the 21-point plan, I'm going to drop the word peace from it now that we've established that is nonsense, is the ousting of Hamas and the empowering of the Palestinian authority. I mean, aside from the problematic issue, which I've already commented on, of white men deciding how brown people will govern themselves, and I know Palestinians, like black folks, we're not a monolith, right? That we have, there's a variety of opinions. Howsomever, this is not just like the Palestinian people are just be like, yay, get rid of Hamas, and oh, yay, the reformists, did I say that? The Palestinian Authority, right, be empowered. My understanding is that's not necessarily the will of the Palestinian people.
Right. And I mean, truthfully, look, Palestinians have a right to determine, you know, what happens to themselves, their society, and their territory. And that has been very like democracy in Gaza has not been possible because they've been besieged. So just first things first, you know, Palestinians deserve self-determination, and that really requires the end of a genocide, right? But the other thing is this rests on this very American and very Israeli notion that Hamas, that there's some like fixed number of Hamas fighters, and we can just identify them all and, you know, eliminate them, that will free, you know, Gaza. And that's not how it works. You know, among other things, when you commit genocide against people, you know, when you murder people's relatives, you know, the notion that anyway, that is part of what has replenished people willing to take up arms against the colonizers that are slaughtering, you know, them and their families. So that's what, when people say, you know, Hamas isn't just an organization, it's an idea. I mean, if it wasn't Hamas, it would be some other organization. And it has been, you know, this is built into an occupation.
Resistance. You're actually taking me, because when we talked about Iraq, and I'm interrupting because I'm short on time, and I sort of jotted it down, but I didn't go there. And what I was going to ask you to do, Kurt, because we were talking about Iraq, right? Oh, because Tony Blair. and we know what happened there, right? That it was so brutal and so awful and so terrible that we then saw opposition movements. Mm-hmm. Spring up that cost a lot of people their lives and were steeped in violence and blood, and we know where it came from. However, what parallels are there to just what you're talking about? You said it's baked in the colonization, right? That people are going to rise up and they're going to resist, and they're going to resist with arms, period.
There's enormous parallels. You know, I think about, there's a Palestinian scholar named Rami Khoury, you know, who has lived in the Middle East for a long time. He lives in Boston now, and he says this all the time. He wrote a really useful book about Hamas called Understanding Hamas. But, you know, he starts his book talks by saying, occupied people are going to resist. That is the nature of occupation, and that resistance will take various forms. There'll be cultural resistance, there'll be political resistance, and if the occupation is armed, there will be armed resistance. That is kind of the nature of this. So that's just the kind of basic, you know, lesson that we have learned from history and that we're learning today. I think the big point, though, is that it's not for the White House or Israel to decide what the political landscape of Palestine looks like. It's just not their call, you know. And when Palestinians in Gaza did elect Hamas 19 years ago, Israel said, you made the wrong choice, and now we're going to blockade you. And it's like, well, that's not how democracy works. It isn't you can vote as long as you vote for the people who we like. It's just not their call. It's not their right. And I will add to the point that, as you pointed out, Israel just carried out an assassination attempt in Qatar against representatives of Hamas. And the head negotiator from Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, was assassinated in Iran. So, you know, the notion that this state, Israel, which literally kills the people at the negotiating table, not the arm, you know, Haniyeh was not an armed fighter, nor were the people who were targeted in Qatar recently. These were the people who talk. That's their job, is talking. And they were targeted for assassination. Mm-hmm. That's how Israel treats the notion of negotiation. Why should that entity have the right to decide what Palestinian political life looks like?
All right, Kerry Peterson-Smith, I want to thank you for hopping on today. Be looking seriously for an email from my producer. We're going to put that Asada panel together this week.
Looking forward to it.
I appreciate you, my G. Take care. Be safe out there.
Appreciate you back. Peace.
We have been talking to Kerry Peterson-Smith, who is a Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.